Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. You're listening to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In 1846, the Latter-day Saints were forced from their homes in Nauvoo, Illinois, and migrated west. What happened with the city next is what we're going to be talking about on Legacy today. We have with us BYU professor Scott Esplin, and he's going to be talking about Nauvoo. Scott, welcome to Legacy.
Thank you.
If you take just a minute, please tell us about yourself and your interest with this subject.
Sure. I, like you mentioned, I'm a professor of church history and doctrine at Brigham Young University, and I became interested in Nauvoo because I focus on 20th century church history, and just found that visitors to Nauvoo, especially Latter-day Saint visitors to Nauvoo, are generally acquainted and introduced to the early history. The saints, as they were there in the 1840s, become acquainted with life and times in Nauvoo during the Joseph Smith era, and of course, then subsequent to him with the Exodus, as you mentioned. But many visitors are unfamiliar with what happened to the town after that, and especially how the church came back to make such a beautifully restored site. Arguably, Nauvoo is outside of Salt Lake City and Temple Square, the most visited Latter-day Saint site of all of our church history sites, and yet many are unfamiliar with how we came back and the fascinating story and what it teaches us about our own history and frankly, about the history of other peoples. So because I like 20th century history, I focused on a topic that maybe some are not as familiar with and hopefully can help us learn some lessons about how we present our message and who we are as a people from the story of Nauvoo.
Excellent. Let's jump back to 1846 just for a minute.
Okay.
As I understand it, many of the members of the church leaving Nauvoo didn't have great luck in selling their property due to persecution and were just obliged to leave it.
Exactly, yeah.
What happened?
The church did leave behind a couple of agents who remained in the city for a short period of time trying to sell properties on behalf of individuals or on behalf of the church, including the Nauvoo Temple itself. They sought a couple of different directions, trying to find a buyer for that building, hoping in many ways to fund the Exodus. But you're right; they had to just simply vacate the homes and hope for their best.
So it was in February 1846 that the majority left. Now, as you say, there were some agents. Were there other members of the church who were there for some months afterwards?
There are, yes. There, of course, Brigham Young and the 12 and church leadership leave in February of 46 and start to push west into Iowa. Brigham has a quite an interesting account of that, an interesting meeting where he reflected. He said as he left, his parting comment was, I met with the Council of the Twelve in the southeast corner room of the attic of the temple. We knelt around the altar and dedicated the building to the Most High. We asked his blessing upon our intended move to the west. Also asked him to enable us someday to finish the temple and dedicate it to him. And we would leave it in his hands to do as he pleased, and to preserve the building as a monument to Joseph Smith. We asked the Lord to accept the labors of his servants in this land. So they dedicate what they have and leave it for those who follow after them. Wilford Woodruff reflected that he prayed as he says, I left Nauvoo for the last time. Perhaps in this life I looked back on the temple and city and asked God to preserve it as a monument for our sacrifice. And that was essentially the attitude as they left. Others who were, especially individuals who may not have been as prepared as the leaders were, struggled throughout the spring and summer to leave Nauvoo. And then with the subsequent Battle of Nauvoo, were ultimately forced out. We call them the poor camp, and they go across and the miracle of the quail and all of those stories associated with their great deliverance. But by fall of 46, the bulk of the saints are gone from Nauvoo.
One of my favorite stories from my family history is Jane Johnston Black, who
delivered lots of babies on the Iowa side after they were forced in September of 1846.
Exactly. Those stories of those saints in the fall of 46 are incredibly inspiring.
So what was Nauvoo like following the church's departure in 1846?
Well, great question. Obviously, people were interested in these vacant homes and the beautiful farmland and the buildings left behind. Word quickly spread of the saints' departure and the availability of farms and homes at reasonable rates. So interest quickly grows about this city. The first group to become significantly interested in it is a group known as the Icarians. They were a French social and political commune group led by a man by the name of Etienne Cabet, who came to Nauvoo in 1849. They purchased much of the property and with plans even to use the Nauvoo Temple for various meetings of theirs and things, and tried to create a commune society there in Nauvoo. Others, farmers and others, came to the area with interest in the land. And of course, we have prominent groups associated with Joseph Smith left in the area still. While the bulk of the saints were gone, Emma Smith, most importantly, is still there in Nauvoo and maintained, of course, the properties associated with the prophet, the red brick store, the Joseph Smith homestead, the mansion house, and the then uncompleted Nauvoo house. So she remains down in the properties near the river, and the Icarians occupy up there on the bluff and near the temple. And then other settlers scatter out throughout the region, occupying farms and the homes. And not enough occupants came in to occupy all the houses that were left, and so some of the houses fall into disrepair, especially down in the flats. But there clearly people came in seeking to use the property and the homes and the land for their own purposes.
So was it mostly the great deals that people could get that drew the Icarians there?
Yes, it was. They were seeking a place where they could establish a community, and having heard of this area, they came north on the Mississippi River to Nauvoo. Their community didn't last long. They were in Nauvoo for only a period of about 7 years. They had a total residency of about 500 individuals who occupied the homes and properties there. Their commune dissolves in 1856, though most of those, or a number of those, residents remained in the area. Their posterity remains in Nauvoo today. So there is a museum dedicated to the Icarians and this French socialistic commune that occupied the city immediately following the vacancy by the saints. The next group in were German immigrants. During the 1850s and 60s and 70s, was a period of German immigration to the United States. And again, having heard about the availability of cheap farmland and homes, they come and occupy Nauvoo, bringing a significantly different element to the city. Nauvoo has been called by some the most German town in Illinois throughout that period. German was spoken frequently, more frequently than English, in the local schools, in the churches. And they introduced another element. They brought with them expertise in grapes and winery and then in cheese making. And so they still celebrate a festival there annually around Labor Day, where they celebrate the grape heritage and the cheese making specialty for which Nauvoo became famous during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There was a blue cheese factory there for a while. And so if you go to Nauvoo today, a number of the longtime resident families will have German last names, and they clearly influenced the town for the latter half of the 19th century as up until World War I, Nauvoo was clearly a very, very German town in Illinois.
You're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're visiting with BYU Professor Scott Esplin, and we're talking about Nauvoo today. What other groups came in about this time and made a difference in Nauvoo's history?
Well, if you've been to Nauvoo today, you'll also see a strong visible presence of the Catholic Church just north of the reconstructed Nauvoo Temple. You'll find a Catholic church there, and for those who visited Nauvoo in earlier eras will remember the Sisters of St. Benedict, who came there in 1874 and created what was known as the St. Mary's Academy and Convent. And those sisters created quite a large number of buildings directly across from the temple up there on the bluffs. And when the church reconstructed the temple, they purchased that property from the Sisters of St. Benedict, and they closed down in the year 2001. But for over 100 years, Nauvoo was known as an area where there was a strong Catholic influence through these sisters who ran a boarding school for girls, and they would come there from all over the country and live on what used to be the edge of the Nauvoo Temple property. So if you go there today, you'll still see in Nauvoo this strong Catholic presence in the church that's there and the school next door. And for those that have been previously in what they may remember as used to be the auditorium across the street and other things as part of the St. Mary's Academy and Convent. So between the Germans, the Catholics, the Icarians, from the 1850s through the early 20th century, Nauvoo had a fascinating non-Mormon story. Throughout all of that, there persisted, of course, elements from then known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ, now the Community of Christ, largely through Emma's posterity. And so the one element you had during that era, as far as Mormon influence was concerned, was the RLDS Church.
So when did the LDS Church actually make a presence again in Nauvoo?
In 1903, the LDS Church began, would be the date when they began turning their interest back to Nauvoo. And actually it doesn't start in Nauvoo. It starts in Carthage. In 1903, Joseph F. Smith, as president of the church, purchased the Carthage jail, and that was the first purchase of a church historic site by the church. Prior to any other purchases in Palmyra or Harmony or anywhere else where we have church history sites today, the first site the church ever purchased was the Carthage jail, and that clearly began the interest among church members regarding the old city of Nauvoo. Visitors started to increase in the area. They started holding mission conferences in Nauvoo in 1904 and 1905. These missionaries would come, and that caused the locals to become quite intrigued by the Mormons. Of course, this is after the end of plural marriage and after difficult times that the church had faced in the late 19th century. And our image is greatly improving. And people became intrigued with this church out in the West who had ties to the rural Midwest. And so our first purchase was the Carthage jail, and then the return of these missionaries to visit in the area greatly concerned the RLDS Church. By then, were the only visible Latter-day Saint element in Nauvoo, and they became greatly concerned as visitors started to stir up interest about coming back to the area. So actually, what that began was interest by the RLDS, now the Community of Christ, in restoring their own properties. They actually began the restoration of Nauvoo movement in the early 20th century, placing guides there, developing what's known as the Lewis Bittman Stable House into their first visitor center. They did some restoration work on the Joseph Smith Homestead, on the Mansion House. By then, the red brick store had fallen into disarray, so they began work on the properties that were in existence, and turned Nauvoo by the 1920s and 30s into an RLDS site, if it was anything associated with Mormonism. But of course, Latter-day Saints, as they traveled, would stop in Nauvoo. So we owned the Carthage jail, but we didn't own anything else in Nauvoo initially. The first thing we did was actually an arrangement with the Community of Christ, then RLDS Church, to place a historical marker on the site of the former red brick store. George Albert Smith presided at that occasion, and with the assistance of Frederick M. Smith, president of the church of the RLDS Church, I placed a marker there, and that began our first visible presence in Nauvoo in the 1930s. But But the next person, even maybe before the church formally became involved, was a man by the name of Wilford Wood. Wood was an entrepreneur here in Utah, from up in Bountiful area, and he especially became interested in acquiring things associated with the history of the church. He made a number of purchases of objects and artifacts and eventually properties associated with the church. His first major one was in 1937, as it relates to Nauvoo, when he purchased a portion of the temple lot in Nauvoo. And there was a fascinating story associated with that. It was going up for auction from the Bank of Nauvoo, and he was authorized on behalf of the church to pay no more than $1,000 for the auction. And when he went out to attend the auction, it was clear that the bank wanted significantly more than that. And he negotiated with them, arguing that asking them if they were going to ask him to pay an exorbitant price for the blood of the martyred prophet, and argued that this property rightfully belongs to the Latter-day Saint people. So the bank agreed that if no one would outbid him at $900, they would sell it to him for that, and went to the auction, and his hope or dream was fulfilled. No one outbid him, and he purchased a portion of the temple lot. And that begins a series of 10 separate transactions spreading across 25 years, wherein the church eventually acquired the entirety of the Nauvoo temple block. So by the 1950s, we owned the Carthage Jail, and we had the temple block. At the same time, Wilford Wood also began acquiring other properties, acquired what was known as the Masonic Hall, now the Cultural Hall in Nauvoo. He also acquired the Times and Seasons building, the John Taylor home down there in the flats, and began having people live there. They opened a Sunday school in the John Taylor home, and the church placed its first site missionaries at the Nauvoo Temple, where they opened a little information bureau, and people could come and learn about the church in the 40s and 50s. That actually sparked quite a swirl of rumors regarding what the church was going to do. What some have called maybe the best-kept secret of Mormonism in the 1990s, the reconstruction of the Nauvoo Temple, was maybe the worst-kept secret of the 1930s. Rumors swirled all over Nauvoo about whether or not they were going to rebuild the temple. There's a newspaper account in the Carthage newspaper reporting that the church was committed to spend $1 million on rebuilding the temple. And much of that was being spurred by Bryant Hinckley. President Hinckley's father was a mission president in the area at the time, and he had great plans for Nauvoo and had been working with the state of Illinois on some sort of arrangement to get the Nauvoo temple rebuilt. World War II hit, and that put a stop to building plans through the 40s. But the church was clearly looking at something with the temple and had made movements that direction. And that greatly concerned the RLDS Church, of course, because the temple would be the most prominent draw to the region. And so that sets up where we were through the 40s and 50s. We owned the temple lot, had a visitor bureau there. Rumors were swirling about our rebuilding the temple, and we began to occupy various homes.
It seems fascinating to me to think who the people were who were actually living there that we were acquiring things from. And it's obvious that they were these descendants of the Icarians, the Catholics, the Germans, and whoever else. But these were all people, and they had lives and stories as well.
Yeah, and that's a little bit some of the challenges with modern-day Nauvoo. If you go there today, I was there last weekend, and there are still some tender feelings, sensitive feelings among local residents, non-affiliated with our faith or non-affiliated with the Community of Christ, who feel like their stories matter too. And maybe there's a lesson there or something we need to be careful with. Clearly, Nauvoo has become a pilgrimage site for Latter-day Saints and a place where people go and remember 1840s Mormonism, but there's much more to its history. It has an Icarian story. It has a German story. It has a Catholic story. And it has the story of Midwest rural America and the rise and fall of family farms. And those people feel strongly about their stories, too. And so as we go, as visitors, we need to be maybe sensitive to their stories and not only ask questions about what was life like as a Mormon here, but clearly, what is life like in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and how does it continue to be those stories matter as well.
We're talking about old and new Nauvoo with Scott Esplin here on Legacy. I'm Nathan Wright. What factors have had the most significant impact on the Nauvoo as we see it today?
You know, I mentioned Wilford Wood. He clearly has a significant influence on Nauvoo in the 1930s and 40s and the acquisition of the temple lot. I mentioned Bryant Hinckley, President Hinckley's father, who had great plans for turning Nauvoo into a place where people could come and learn about the church. He organized a series of centennials when Nauvoo celebrated its 100th anniversary of its founding, and then a centennial caravan commemorating the exodus from Nauvoo and other things. But beyond those two, there's clearly one individual who stands out, maybe above and beyond them all. His name is J. Leroy Kimball. Dr. Kimball was a physician here in Salt Lake and a descendant of Heber C. Kimball. And he went to medical school at the University of Chicago in the 1930s and came back in the 1950s where he acquired his great-grandfather's home, Heber C. Kimball's home there in Nauvoo, just a private purchase on his own, with plans of restoring it to its previous splendor and having it as a summer home for Dr. Kimball and his family. And he worked through the 1950s and early in restoring the home until by 1960. He asked a relative of his and of Heber C. Kimball's, Spencer W. Kimball, to come and dedicate the home as the restoration was complete. And a significant number of people showed up for the dedication. And then people kept coming to ask to see the home and coming to tour it. And Dr. Kimball later recalled he never had the chance to spend a night in his own home because everyone was always coming to tour the place. And that sparked a thought in him that maybe other people would be interested in the rest of Nauvoo. So he quietly began making some significant purchases on his own of the Brigham Young home, the Wilford Woodruff home, and other properties all throughout old Nauvoo. He then approached church officials in Salt Lake with the idea that maybe we can make something out of Nauvoo again. And in 1962, the first presidency created what's known as Nauvoo Restoration Incorporated, or by the acronym NRI. And this nonprofit organization had great plans for Nauvoo. Its original board members, of course, included Dr. Kimball as the president. But individuals, prominent Mormons of the era, J. Willard Marriott, David M. Kennedy, Secretary of the Treasury, and others were on that original board, as well as non-LDS people. They had a representative from Colonial Williamsburg. They had a representative from the National Parks Service. And they had great plans for turning Nauvoo into what they called a Colonial Williamsburg of the Midwest.
Right.
And I was looking at the plans the other day. Those plans included, with Marion on the board, hotels and a golf course and a university, and then, of course, restoring the homes and various ideas regarding what to do with the temple. And so by the 1960s, they underwent some significant restorations in Nauvoo. They conducted an archaeological dig of the entire temple site. They did archaeological digs of the Brigham Young home, the Jonathan Browning home and gunsmith site, the Webb blacksmith shop. And this nonprofit organization turned Nauvoo into, with obviously interest from the state of Illinois and others, turned Nauvoo into a place to be seen for all the people traveling post-World War II across the new highways and things of America. The design was to put Nauvoo on the map. And so by the 1960s, Nauvoo was going to be a place where history was going to be the focus. And you could come and learn about, just like you could go to Colonial Williamsburg and learn about colonial life, you could come to Nauvoo and learn about life on a Midwestern farm town on the Mississippi River in the 1840s. So Dr. Kimball led NRI for decades with that mission, and he acquired dozens and dozens of properties in more than 100, I think, separate transactions, where he eventually occupies maybe two-thirds to three-quarters of the entire town today. Farmland surrounding the area and everything. NRI becomes a huge economic boom to Nauvoo. But with that obviously comes some hurt feelings. The Community of Christ, then the RLDS Church, became greatly interested with its neighboring, with its sister religion occupying neighboring property. And obviously the two faiths had different points of view regarding Joseph Smith and points of his doctrines and interpretations of him and especially his successors. So there became some periods of conflict between the two faiths. And of course, local residents benefited those who sold their properties to Dr. Kimball and others, benefited economically, but others were hurt as maybe Nauvoo was no longer the small rural town that they were familiar with and that they grew up hoping it would always be. So it became quite a conflict in the 1960s and 70s between the various groups.
I served my mission in the Iowa Des Moines mission in 78 to 80, and Nauvoo at that time was part of my mission, and I got to be a proselyting missionary in Nauvoo for just a couple of months. But during my tenure there as a missionary, the 1,000th stake of the church was created in Nauvoo, Illinois. It was a very exciting time when President Benson came. And any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, that your comment about missionary work really is what happened, the change that occurred in Nauvoo. In when David O. McKay died in 1970, his successors maybe viewed Nauvoo differently than what NRI or Nauvoo Restoration Incorporated and President McKay had originally created. The project had become very tourist-oriented, very historical and archaeologically focused. And in other individuals, his successors, felt like we needed to emphasize more the mission aspect of Nauvoo, its proselyting potentials. And so there was a separate Nauvoo mission created in 1971. Dr. Kimball was made the first mission president of the Nauvoo mission. They started to call senior couples there. From Salt Lake or through Salt Lake, the missionary department, calls would be issued to senior couples to Nauvoo. They created or built during that era, dedicated early in the 1970s, the beautiful Nauvoo Visitor Center there, with which visitors are familiar. And the focus clearly went towards proselyting, and that allowed for the creation of the pageant with which people are familiar. And Nauvoo went away from this. As you know, you won't see there in Nauvoo today a church owned or an NRI owned golf course and hotel. And there was plans for a marina. There was plans for the Maid of Iowa running up and down the river again, and things that there was plans for a university, things that people could do in Nauvoo. And the 1970s scaled all of that back, and the church decided to make its focus for Nauvoo and largely other historic sites. Places where visitors could come and be introduced to the church, and that changed our focus. And so, when you were there as a missionary, you probably experienced some of that. You were under the era in which missionaries were coming to serve in Nauvoo, and people were participating in the pageant. And if you were there in the late 1970s, that's also the time when they erected the Monument to Women, beautiful statues behind the Visitor Center, And so we took a different focus for Nauvoo. Nauvoo became a place where individuals and church members could come and celebrate the life and mission of Joseph Smith and learn more about his ministry, as opposed to life in a Midwestern Mississippi River farm town. And that clearly didn't sit well with some individuals who thought Nauvoo was supposed to be archaeologically Colonial Williamsburg type idea based, that it also greatly concerned the then RLDS Church, who felt like if we were going to step up our proselyting efforts, they had to do something by way of response. Guides of that era have later joked that the goal of the tour guides in Nauvoo was to spoil Mormons' vacations, and they would bring up issues of polygamy, of course, and temple doctrines, and make comments. And I think it was going on both sides of the divide in that town as it became almost a battleground. The RLDS Church decided to take a different approach as we moved more towards proselyting. they moved, ironically, into the historical specialty that we vacated. Our original focus was historical expertise, and as we left that area, they took it over. And so the focus for Nauvoo for them is incredibly historical. And they went so far as, in celebration of the sesquicentennial of the church, they rebuilt the red brick store. And so during the 1970s and 80s, a period of what you could call a building boom, anything you can do, we can do better, occurred in Nauvoo. And so as we would build a visitor center, they would build a visitor center. As they would restore the red brick store, we would restore the 70s hall or other sites. And so the two faiths competed in brick and mortar for the interpretive position of Nauvoo. And so during all of this, of course, then you have the locals, non-affiliated with either faith, who are scratching their heads wondering what's happening to their town. And as they see their town become, in some ways, a mecca for Mormonism. And then again, they form their own historical society that tries to preserve the memory of the Icarians, the memory of the German settlers, the memory of the Catholic school. And so you really have these divides in Nauvoo, unfortunately, during the 70s and 80s, as three different camps kind of vie for the interpretive higher ground. And it becomes a difficult time for Nauvoo.
So what's going on now?
Well, you know, all of that supposedly ended in 1989. In 1989, the church rededicated again some improvements on the Carthage Jail property, and did the old Pioneer Burial Ground, which is on the outskirts of Nauvoo. They did the Lion Drug Store and several other smaller sites, the Riser Boot and Shoemaker Shop. And then Elder Lauren C. Dunn, the president of NRI at the time, announced that Nauvoo was done with the construction phase. It was moving into a preservation phase. They announced that enough had been done to give an impressionistic view of Nauvoo, and they were going to stop the major construction in the area. And that is how it sat for about a decade. All of that time, of course, you had one significant property that kind of languished, that remained clearly the focus of old Nauvoo, but never had anything really done with it. And that was the Nauvoo Temple site. We, of course, had, they had laid, after they had finished the archaeological digs and things of the 1960s, they had laid, if you remember that era, they had laid bricks outlining the footprint of the Nauvoo Temple, where the baptistry was, where the staircase was, and over different periods of time, they had a little model of the Nauvoo Temple up on that site, and they had obviously missionaries there to explain it and different things. But they had flowers and tried to beautify the site, hedges and things, but it remained obviously the focus of old Nauvoo that had never been touched. And so the church, though the church denounced the end of construction, President Hinckley obviously significantly changed that in 1999 when he announced the reconstruction of the Nauvoo Temple. And in some ways, I think that building, like it ended the earlier era of Nauvoo, the Nauvoo Temple being the last major Mormon building built in the 1840s, in some ways, the reconstruction of that temple ended the building boom again in Nauvoo. If you're going on with the phase of anything you can do, we can do better, you can't really trump the temple. And so once they had rebuilt that building and dedicated it in 2002, things seemed to have calmed down in Nauvoo. Of course, there's been other things built associated with the temple. Most recently, there's a Nauvoo Accommodation Center, or a place where people coming to the temple can go and if they've been traveling a long ways, get changed and get ready to enter that sacred edifice. They've also built housing for the temple missionaries that are required to staff that location. But so it introduced another element of Nauvoo that hadn't been there in the past. Previously, you had, from an LDS perspective, you had the Historic Sites Division of the church. You had the missionary department of the church, and now you've introduced the temple department of the church. And those three entities work together very well, trying to manage the message of Nauvoo. But With the completion of the temple introduced, again, some of those strong feelings among the locals. Obviously, that building significantly impacted traffic in the area, all the construction traffic and things. But things have slowed down in Nauvoo now, with most of the construction having wound down, at least for the present, as it seems to be. And importantly, I think it's allowed for the faiths to get along better now. The temple, in some ways, has brought us together. With the end of construction, people are now able to explore a little bit more other stories in Nauvoo. Maybe we're giving a little more time to the stories of the Icarians, the stories of the Germans, the stories of the Catholics, the stories of the agricultural farmers and others in the area that hopefully their stories are becoming valued. And at the same time, we're working very well with the Community of Christ. Today, we arranged a series of land swaps between the two faiths to create a more clean divide. If you've been to Nauvoo, and you might be familiar with where the RLDS Church or the Community of Christ's chapel or meeting hall is today, their meeting hall used to be right in the middle of NRI property, and they needed a new building. And we arranged the church arranged a land swap wherein we took the property that was in NRI, clearly in the NRI region of the city, and in exchange for some properties that they were interested in independence. And that's created some good working relationships. There's been some good directors of the Community of Christ's historic sites there, including their current director, Lachlan Mackay, and our own mission presidents for Nauvoo and presidents of NRI. Area presidents in the region have worked hard to have good working relationships with the Community of Christ and with the residents. So representatives from NRI, representatives from the Community of Christ, sit on the town's ministerial association. They plan community religious events together. They plan community social events together. The missionaries, the temple missionaries, the local residents interact much better than they have in the past. And in some ways, I think that's healing the divide. Nauvoo was a place of division in the 1840s. It was a place where Mormonism splintered into various factions, and clearly it caused conflict with other faiths. And hopefully, we're overcoming some of that. Hopefully, we're making Nauvoo a place where it can become truly the City Beautiful, where, as the Lord said in section 124, the weary traveler can come and contemplate the beauty of Zion. And hopefully that's coming about in Nauvoo today.
We've talked about the sensitivity we should show to locals and other religions as we visit Nauvoo. What is there anything else that we need to know about the return to Nauvoo, Illinois?
Well, clearly Nauvoo is also a place where we can celebrate the life and mission and ministry of the Prophet Joseph Smith. It's his town. It's the city of Joseph. And especially with the reconstruction of the Nauvoo Temple, visitors can go and reflect on the saving doctrines the Lord introduced through his prophet there, the ability for families to be eternal, the ability to do work for our dead. Nauvoo is a place where, in some ways, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as it exists today, headquartered in Salt Lake, was born in Nauvoo. The doctrines we are most well known for, our emphasis on families, on eternal families, on work for the dead, the ideas of eternal progression, those are Nauvoo doctrines, Nauvoo concepts. And so Nauvoo is a great place to go back and see the crowning jewel of Joseph Smith's mission and to celebrate him, his life and ministry and what the Lord accomplished through him. It's also a place to come together with other faiths and in some ways try to find what we have in common, obviously not diminishing what great things the Lord has done, but realizing that the Lord loves all of his people and trying to share with them get all the good we can, as Joseph Smith once taught, bring all the good that you have, and then we'll see if we can add to it. And clearly the other faiths and other interested parties in Nauvoo have great good. And if we can get good from them and then see where we can add, Nauvoo can be a great place where the crowning jewel of Mormonism can rise again.
Thank you. We've been visiting with BYU Professor Scott Esplin, and the subject has been Nauvoo. It's a topic that never seems to lose its vitality for so many of us. Scott, thanks again for joining us here in Legacy.
Well, thank you, Nathan. I'm glad to be here.
I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We invite you to listen to new episodes of Legacy Saturdays at 1 o'clock. You can also download any Legacy episode at mormonchannel.org.